A teenager in Thomasville, Georgia, is facing charges for allegedly stealing a gun from a car earlier this month. This is a problem that we have seen across the state. The investigative news website The Trace looked at the stolen gun problem in Atlanta. In 2016, they found that Atlanta led many cities with its rate of guns taken from automobiles. I talked about this with journalist Brian Frescos. He told me that in the year 2015, there were about 850 guns stolen from cars in Atlanta alone.
We have data from more than 50 cities, and that was by far, Atlanta had by far the highest number of any city in our reporting. We also found that these laws or these thefts had been on the rise in a number of cities as lawmakers had rolled back restrictions on storing and carrying firearms in vehicles, including there in Georgia.
Yeah, you also looked at gun thefts in Savannah. What'd you find there?
Savannah also had a high number of thefts from vehicles. It was in the 180 range, I believe, was the number for Savannah. Savannah is one of the cities that we're still kind of working with to hammer down exactly how many were stolen. We've had some problems with the data from there.
Yeah, how have you been gathering these data? Are the kinds of thefts that we're talking about, thefts of guns from cars, are these typically well documented by police?
No, they typically aren't. We found that a number of police departments don't do a very good job of tracking this problem, if they track it at all. In Savannah, for instance, they sent us a data set that detailed some of the gun thefts, but there appeared to be duplicate entries. And so what we had to do for them and what we had to do for a couple of other cities was just look at the number of cases where at least one gun was stolen. And we're trying to go back now and figure out how many of those cases resulted in more than one gun that was stolen. Like in Atlanta, we found several cases where a thief broke into a car and made off with four or five weapons.
Wow. Now, this phenomenon that we've been talking about, the iron pipeline, this is well documented. We know that there are guns that are obtained via many methods, legal and illegal, in states like Georgia and then moved into states like your own, like New York, where it can be a lot harder to get a gun and therefore the black market for guns is a lot more robust. But is there any reason to think that these particular guns that we're talking about, Brian, guns that are stolen from cars in cities like Atlanta and Savannah, that those end up going into the pipeline and going into other states where they're presumably used for crime?
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of reason to believe that happens. One thing that the police department told us in Atlanta is that these guns, a very small percentage of these guns that are stolen there in Atlanta are actually recovered there in Atlanta. Most of them are recovered in other places, sometimes out of state.
My guest is Brian Frescos. He's a reporter with The Trace, which is a publication focusing on gun issues. You say in your article, you point very, very quickly to Georgia's regulatory environment, very permissive regulatory environment for guns, as being related to the phenomenon that you're writing about. But ultimately, it's illegal to steal a gun from anywhere. So what do regulations have to do with gun theft?
Absolutely. Well, there's a number of things that can prevent gun theft, and there's a number of things that can increase the opportunities for gun theft. And one thing that we've seen in Georgia has made it legal for people for permitted gun owners to keep their firearms in their cars at work. And it has also loosened restrictions around where permit holders are allowed to carry their firearms. And what several experts have told us is that as more people are just carrying these guns around, it increases the likelihood that they're going to leave them somewhere where a thief can gain ready access to it. So we've seen a number of states, try to crack down on firearm theft. California actually was the most recent to pass a bill requiring law enforcement officers and permit holders who leave guns in their cars to either have them in a safe box or in a trunk. And I say permitted holders because non-permitted gun owners were already required to do that. So they now expanded that law to make it harder for thieves to gain access to firearms.
Any other methods that you've seen cities and states using to try to crack down on this problem, people stealing guns from cars?
Yeah, well, one thing that's been getting a lot of attention is the fact that only 9 states in D.C. require firearms that are lost or stolen to be reported to law enforcement.
Wow.
And so we've seen some areas try to take some steps to increase the reporting of lost and stolen firearms. And that really helps law enforcement crack down on trafficking and determine where this problem is occurring and deploy resources accordingly. New Orleans was the most recent one, I believe. In August, they just passed a law that required residents to report lost or stolen guns within 48 hours of discovering the loss or theft.
What did officials in Georgia tell you about how they are tackling this problem, if at all?
Well, in Georgia, I was focusing a lot of my reporting on Atlanta,
sure,
where we had seen the most gun thefts. And I spoke with one of the high-ranking police officials there, and didn't seem like at the time that they were very aware that this was a rising problem there. But after we started making inquiries and compiling the data, they created a public service announcement, a commercial, if you will, to try to encourage gun owners to lock their guns up and keep them unloaded and safe. So we got some good responses to our reporting, and hopefully it will, you know, prevent some gun owners from losing their firearms in the future.
Yeah, the power of investigative reporting. That's got to make you feel good. My guest is Brian Frescos. He's a reporter for The Trace. We've got a link to his story about stolen guns, guns being stolen from cars in Atlanta, and then potentially ending up in other parts of the country where they're used for crimes. That link is at gpbnews.org. Well done, Brian. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
This weekend, we saw rallies across Georgia and the nation in response to gun violence. Hundreds of thousands turned out to call for reforms in the nation's gun laws. 21-year-old Samaje Clark has firsthand experience about the trauma that a bullet can cause. A few years ago, he was paralyzed after being shot in Savannah. He now uses a wheelchair. Before becoming a vocal anti-gun violence advocate, Samaje was involved in gang activity. He says that media have a responsibility when they cover these shootings.
My name is Samaje Clark, and I'm currently based in Los Angeles, California. I was out in Savannah for about 17 months. Being shot is like it's a crazy experience. I was shot 3 times when I was 15 in my own neighborhood. I was shot another time when I was 16, and I got shot 3 times in Savannah, Georgia, just going out there to go do a speech. The first time I got shot, it felt like hot iron going through my skin. And the third time I got shot, it was crazy. I just felt like a massive thump hit my spine, and I just felt my legs go out. I hit the floor. I tried to get up, and I couldn't get up. I was in group homes, foster homes, and I was exposed to a lot growing up, so at an early age, my mind was on a different level than other kids, so I just started to hang with other people. I started to hang with older people, and I started to get in trouble. I was involved in gang violence, but it wasn't what I thought it was. You know, like in the end, I found out, you know, that the streets really, you know, they don't love nobody, and it's really nothing out there for you. And that's really the message that I push now to the youth, because, like, yeah, I went looking in the streets, but I didn't really found nothing. And when the time came down to it, I didn't really have nobody who had my back. So
we start with more violence tonight in East Savannah. Metro police say 3 people were shot near East 55th and Cedar Streets.
A man is on the run tonight after allegedly shooting another man this evening in West Macon.
When I see news coverage, I feel like they shouldn't identify people as gangsters or thugs or hoodlums, you know, because that just makes it look crazy on the other end to the people who are viewing it and the people who have never been in that area. A problem I have with the news coverage is they make it seem like that we're putting the guns in our community. Like, yeah, it just makes me feel like, you know, they look at us like we're monsters or something, like we're just animals. I think they should know what they're saying, or know who they're calling a thug, or know who they're calling a super predator or gangster, or just identify who they're talking about. I think I lost probably like 12 or 13 friends to gun violence. Yeah, every time I look up in the sky, I see one of my friends or one of my homies, you know, telling me good job or watch out, you know, don't do that. You know, like they keep me going. They keep me on the right path.
That was 21-year-old Samaje Clark, who was shot several years ago in Savannah. It left him paralyzed. He shared that story with On Second Thought producer Sean Powers. And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think should be done to curb gun violence? Call us at 404-500-9457, or you can reach us on Twitter. We're at OST Talk. March is Women's History Month, and all this month we're paying tribute to female trailblazers. Author Alice Walker is best known for her novel The Color Purple. In 1983, she became the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Walker's rural Georgia upbringing in Eatonton has heavily influenced her writing. She spoke in 2015 with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley.
I think that many people who love your work, and I have to imagine that's the way, as an artist and a writer, that's the way most people, general people, know you, although you're incredibly active and have always been in activism. I think people sometimes forget your history as part of the civil rights movement, which goes back to your days as a student at Spelman. Can you explain to me what that path was like? And what I mean by that is, at the same time that you're learning how to become a novelist and a writer, you're also focusing a great deal of attention on activism. You're taking time off to lead voter registration drives. Were those two separate paths, the art and the activism?
Well, no, you have to understand that if you're going to be an artist, you need to, for instance, be able to make a living. And if you can't make a living except doing, you know, chores that were specifically designed for just black people, then that is not, you know, that's not a good thing. So you have to go against the culture that is actually forcing you to do things that are likely to make it impossible for you to be an artist. So, for instance, one of the things that still prevailed when I was growing up was that I couldn't try on a dress in a store, on the main street. And that could really upset your whole life, not to mention the day, you know, that your mother brought you into the store.
So let me take you back then, since you mentioned growing up. I read one place where you said you had to hide your writing from your family. You started writing when you were about 8 years old?
Sometime early, yeah.
Why did you keep that secret?
Well, when you grow up in a family of, you know, lots of people.
Yeah, you were the youngest of eight, right?
Seven brothers and sisters. And a very, very, very small house and very little paper. So it was better to keep things from my two brothers, who were very likely to, you know, want to intrude and read and laugh and whatever. So I learned to write in my head much more than on paper for many, many, many years. And in fact, I almost never did drafts until quite late in my writing life. I preferred to compose things almost entirely in my head and then write once and that would probably be it. But it would take a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. Do you think that has, in the end, affected your writing style?
I don't know. I mean, I would imagine everything you do affects, you know, what you produce.
Yeah.
But it helped me because it saved a lot of trees. And I was glad of that because I always loved trees. And I just liked the reality that people, human beings, are so beautifully made that we can hold an awful lot in the mind and work on things in the mind, and you know, and there's a freedom to that, so that often you can just avoid a lot of things that are going on around you because you have a world that is full in your own imagination.
I wanted to ask you about Zora Neale Hurston, who seems to have been a constant influence for you? And I mean, going, people said that you almost single-handedly rescued her from obscurity. You went and actually found her gravesite back in the 70s. You've had a link with her most of your life. What draws you to her?
Because I didn't have a link. She died when I was a junior in high school, and I had no clue that she'd even existed. When I went away to college at Sarah Lawrence in New York, my teacher had known her, but never mentioned her. Her name was in the first book I was published in, but because, you know, at that time we thought only the men were writers, I never even noticed. And so years later, when I discovered that she had existed, that she'd written Their Eyes Were Watching God, and I adored it, I couldn't believe how she had been so, forgotten by people who had known her and so ignored. And then to discover that she'd also been vilified and very badly treated. So, yes, I loved her so much, and I went to Florida, and I found the only sunken place in this huge field that could have been her grave, and that was, you know, a wonderful thing for me. I felt, that was something that she really deserved, and now people love her, and they go there by the thousands every year.
You know, I wonder, Zora Neale Hurston could have been a cautionary tale if you'd seen her that way, in terms of being careful about the way that your activism and your political voice may influence the way people see you and treat you. And I wonder if you ever thought about that. You've been so active all your life, and you have never shied away from putting that into your novels and your poems and all of the other writing that you do. Did it ever concern you that it might affect the way that you were treated, or whether you were published, or the way you were reviewed?
Oh, well, yes, and it has of course affected everything my whole life. But what you learn is that it is such a joy to be able to speak what you see and to share what you know, that it's worth the consequences. So I've always felt that. And I think she did too. I mean, in her case, it was to show the beauty of African-American Southern culture. And she was going to do that whether people liked it or didn't like it or whatever they had to say about her. She paid the price, and I think you just have to be willing to accept that whatever other people do is their business. You know, your business is what the mission that you're on, and it's not something that's negotiable, really. I mean, it's just who you are and what you are put here to do.
So, in your book, Possessing the Secret of Joy, since we're talking about joy here, this is a book that's it's difficult to read, and I don't mean the writing itself is difficult. It's that you are talking about the issue, the practice of female genital mutilation in parts of Africa and the Middle East and other places, and you do not shy away at all from graphic depictions. It's a beautiful book. But it's hard for me to imagine how you came at the beauty and the language with such a topic. And I wonder if you said you don't write drafts, but do you go back and on a book like that to make sure of where that line is?
Oh, yeah. No. By then, I was doing drafts. I was just explaining that in the beginning, I didn't do many drafts because I had learned to be very careful of people intruding, and also we didn't have a lot of money to spend on paper. But no, of course, as I went along, I could afford paper, and I could afford drafts, and I could throw things in the waste paper basket. But yeah, with that particular book, it's just that I love little girls. I love children, and I couldn't imagine. I learned about this when I was in Kenya. When I was, in my 20s, I guess, and it was so shocking that I just hid it from myself for decades. I couldn't imagine what I could do or if anybody could do this, because we're talking about millions of children, and so I worried it and worried it for a long time, And then I realized that it was obviously something that I had been trained to do, to write about this. My background was so poor and so hard, and yet somehow my parents and my community had sent me off, and I had become educated and I could write. And then the universe had said, "Well, here, look at this." And so it was clear to me that I was there. I had the tools, and I should do this work. And I did it, and I'm very glad. I know a lot of people have been very unhappy. And, I've heard from a couple of the surgeons who do this in hospitals in the West, for instance, in London and New York and, other places, which, is shocking enough.
Yeah.
But they, they had thought that instead of doing it in an unhygiene way, we should do it, hygienically in a hospital, as if that helps the child later on who has to grow into an adult who has to deal with the consequences of being mutilated in this way.
A lot of scholars say that novel, Possessing the Secret of Joy, is part of a trilogy with The Temple of My Familiar and The Color Purple. And I wonder if that's how you intend... I mean, scholars are writing about them that way, but I wonder if that's how you intended them.
No, I don't believe in sequels, and I don't believe in trilogies for myself. Other people could have them. But no, I mean, the characters sometimes are, Tashi is in... On one page.
Tashi's the African wife of Seeley's son from the novel Possessing the Secret of
Joy.
Right. Yeah.
But this is her story, and it's not really... But on the other hand, if people want to read it that way, I really don't mind. I mean, read it however you'd like. But I don't... I remember when we made the movie of The Color Purple, and they were wondering and wanting a sequel... And I said, absolutely not. I mean, I don't want any spinoffs. I don't want, to wake up one day and have, some crazy, idiotic sentences coming out of anybody else's mouth. Seeley's or Suge's or Sophia's or Mister's. It would be horrendous. Because each work comes as a whole, complete thing itself. And you don't have any plots and plans, I mean, at least I don't, for trying to spin it off into something else. I have to be really drawn to each individual subject and each situation, and then I give it my full attention for a couple of years.
Now, you've described yourself as a womanist as opposed to a feminist. What does that mean? What's the difference?
Well, I'm an African American. My adventure, and actually it has been an adventure, but reality here in the United States is very different from that of a white person or a white woman. So, there is feminism, which is a valid thing, and I am fine to be a feminist, but womanism means that I incorporate and that I stand firmly in my tradition as an African American woman and what that has meant.
Is that a response? There has been a lot of complaints from women of color that the feminist movement, the new feminist movement, is a largely white female movement and is sometimes insensitive and sometimes openly aggressive to the struggles of women of color. Is that part of what you're responding to?
Well, I think the truth is really that. What we're seeing is something that has been going on all the time, is that, generally speaking, I think many white feminists have seen the struggle to be equal with the white man, and that is to basically, be a bit above everybody else as a couple. And this is the history, I mean, that is just the reality. And I think many women of color and other, women in the world have assumed that feminism meant that your loyalty would be to all the women of the planet. It wouldn't be to marry the top guy and then rule over everybody else. But what seems to be somewhat unsettling is the notion that the white woman who comes to consciousness about her own inequality, because she's female, is actually wanting just to be equal with the man who's on top.
That was Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker speaking with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley. That conversation is part of a series we're presenting this month to salute Women's History Month. Alice Walker spoke at Emory University and recited her poem, I Will Keep Broken Things.
The big clay pot with raised iguanas chasing their tails. Two of their fierce heads sheared off. I will keep broken things. The old slave market basket brought to my door by Mississippi. A jagged hole gouged in its sturdy, dark oak side. I will keep broken things. The memory of those long, delicious night swims with you. I will keep broken things. In my house, there remains an honored shelf on which I will keep broken things. Their beauty is, they need not ever be fixed. I will keep your wild, free laughter, though it is now missing its reassuring and graceful hinge. I will keep broken things. Thank you so much. I will keep broken things. I will keep you, pilgrim of sorrow. I will keep myself.
That's Georgia author Alice Walker reciting her poem, I Will Keep Broken Things, at Atlanta's Emory University. Marvel's Black Panther recently passed the $1 billion mark at the box office. It is now the top-grossing superhero film of all time in North America. The latest Marvel installment was mostly filmed in Georgia. Taraja Ramsey's, whom we met a few months ago, helps make the sets for Netflix's hit show Stranger Things, also filmed in Georgia, by the way. But he also does stunt work, and one of his latest credits is for Black Panther.
I was on Black Panther as a stunt person for about a month, and that was like one of the best experiences of my life. I got to work with some of the top martial artists in the world, people that I grew up watching on TV, like Clayton Barber, and the guy that's the stunt double for Black Panther, he's one of the best trickers in the world. Like, I was just amazed seeing what he can do, and what he can do is like 100 times what I can do. So that was very impressive, and I was admiring a lot of people on set because it was just a beautiful experience. I wish I knew earlier the probability of me getting into the stunt world, because, you know, that was something I always wanted to do as a kid, was stunts. And so I didn't realize until maybe like 2 or 3 years ago that the opportunity was available for me to do some stunts. And once I met a couple of stunt coordinators and was, you know, I started inquiring about what it takes to be a stunt guy. And I figured, yeah, I could do this too. You know, I've been taking falls and getting beat up my whole life, so... Might as well do it for a paycheck, you know, and do it because I love it, you know, because that's my passion, really.
That's Taraja Ramsis of Atlanta. He does stunt work in Marvel's Black Panther movie. Greg Waddell of Marietta is another crew member who's worked on several Georgia-made movies. In Black Panther, he worked as a grip, one of those unexplained job titles that just roll past at the end of a film. We asked him to explain what grips do.
Every day I get asked that because most people don't understand. It's you're basically lighting and camera support. You are a workforce that's provided to the director of photography in order to facilitate a lot of things. Anything that the camera attaches to, typically a grip not only builds it but operates that, and especially when it involves camera movement. And then anything that the lighting attaches to, typically a grip is involved with that. If there's structural pieces with scaffolding and truss work and motor systems and things like that, grips do that also. I did one of the first Georgia workforce development programs that they had. It was just a tiny little safety seminar that we did, but it began that handshake with the workforce development system. And through them, I'm working to try to develop an apprenticeship program that can be used to train film technicians. Through education, we can break those barriers down and create equal opportunities for people, and so that diversity is a better conversation to have.
That's Greg Waddell, a grip on Marvel's Black Panther movie. Those interviews were originally recorded for The Credits Podcast. It is online at thecreditspodcast.com. Black Panther is an example of an important change on screens, the rise of superheroes of color. It's not the only black superhero project that calls Georgia home, though. On tomorrow's show, we'll meet one of the stars of the CW show Black Lightning. Both of these projects typify important contributions of black filmmakers, but there are many early black filmmakers who aren't well known. Atlanta filmmaker Brett Wood is working to change that. He's compiled a collection of so-called race films that go back to the silent era. Turner Classic Movies featured some of these films. I asked Brett to explain the term race film.
Well, it was a film made primarily between the World Wars, from the 1910s through the 1940s, featuring African-American performers and more often than not made by black filmmakers. And they were made to be exhibited in theaters that catered to black audiences.
Is race film a term that they would have used at the time, or is that historians looking back and applying that label in retrospect?
Yeah, I think race films or race movies is the term that it's pretty universal. And even though now we say African-American cinema, race films or race movies is still an acceptable term.
Okay. Why start this collection, Brett? On first inspection, you seem to be a white guy. What's your connection to this stuff?
You know, I've always been fascinated by films that haven't been given their proper due in the whole narrative of American film history. I've always been interested in silent films, films that are lost, films that orphan films that were not made by the studios or that were made by independent filmmakers. So that whole idea of unearthing an underappreciated film is a key part of what I do as a producer of Blu-rays and DVDs.
Let's just go ahead and jump right into a clip here. And folks, these are really old movies. The audio is not always great, so put on your best listening ears. One of the films, Brett, that you feature in this collection, it's 1931's Hot Biscuits. It's a short comedy about a rivalry between two men who compete against each other in a high-stakes game of mini-golf. Let's listen to a scene from Hot Biscuits.
Hey, what's your name anyhow, old joker?
My name is Biscuit. Just plain old Hot Biscuit. Now, if you know anybody that wants to play some 10-cent coon cans, send them right down the street here to my shining stand. Because I'll play anybody, brother. Just tell them to come down there and ask for Biscuit.
That ain't a way to spell Biscuit.
Oh, that's the way we spell it in Atlanta.
That film, virtually unseen for more than 80 years, and it's not just because nobody wanted to see it. It couldn't be found. How did you come across it?
It's one of these, almost lost films that we rediscovered. It was lost even though it was sort of hiding at the Library of Congress. What happened is one of the curators of the collection, Jacqueline Stewart, really wanted us to include it, and we said, well, this film doesn't seem to exist. And she said, no, it's at the Library of Congress, trust me. So I contacted the Library of Congress and they searched their database. Let's search Biscuits. Couldn't find the film. And they're like, we don't think this film exists. And fortunately, she had taken a photo of the title screen back when she saw it in the 90s. And we realized it spelled Biscuits is spelled B-I-S-K-I-T-S. Therefore, no one could find it at the Library of Congress. It was just hiding in the database somewhere.
Yeah, so, but that's how we spell it in Atlanta.
Exactly. But, you know, and then what do you know? We sort of rediscovered a film that most people have never heard of and most people didn't think had survived.
We'll listen to another clip from another film in just a second here. But these films, as you say, Brett, primarily starring African-Americans, made by African-Americans, made for an African-American audience. Such films have trouble getting funding to be made today. I can't imagine in the 20s or the 30s. Where did the money come from? Did the studios pay for these films?
No, strictly independently financed. Some companies were bigger than others, were a little bit better organized than others, but they were all made well below the technical and economic level of even a Hollywood B picture. I mean, these are really low-budget endeavors. And it's a testament to the entrepreneurship of the filmmakers and the fact that they were so well organized in not only the film production, but distribution and exhibition.
So if we think back to the 1930s, the early 20th century, the Great Migration is what's happening in Black America, right?
Right.
Black people moving from our part of the country, from a rural lifestyle in the South, up to major cities in the North to work in factories. One of the films in your collection that touches on the urban migration is called Birthright. It's from 1938. It's about a Harvard graduate who returns to his southern home to create an all-black school. Here's a clip from of that film. It's from someone in that community who doesn't want this to happen. He doesn't want this Harvard grad to start this all-black school back in his southern hometown.
White folks and Negroes got along pretty well around here till you got back from school. But since you got back, a lot of unpleasant things have been happening. Now, there ain't room in this here town for the white folks and an educated Negro like you. So if I was you, I'd just drift on away quietly, Peter. Quietly.
Now, the film's director there, a gentleman named Oscar Micheaux, apparently had strong feelings about the need for African-American communities to establish strong centers of rural life. Why did he feel that way at this time in the 30s?
He had actually began as a homesteader, as a farmer in the Midwest, and eventually moved to the city to sort of raise money to continue this, and became a novelist and then became a filmmaker. And even though he was an urbanite, he still had this compulsion to return to the land. And so he made films that sort of encouraged African Americans to return to the South or return to the Midwest and be farmers and start schools and sort of build those communities. Part of the urban migration allowed city centers to emerge that allowed African Americans the chance to have, you know, a new level of wealth and sort of to incubate Black culture in a lot of ways. But at the same time, these communities had their downsides, and you see that a lot in the films where there's crime and there's corruption. And so, you know, Micheaux would never really say one is better than the other, but the land for him was always the hope. It was the future. It was the place where he felt like African Americans could build new communities that hopefully didn't have the sort of the dangers and pitfalls of the city.
That's Atlanta filmmaker and producer Brett Wood. He's behind a collection of works by early African American filmmakers. It's called Pioneers of African American Cinema. Were all of these films, Brett, generally, did they have social messages? Were they serious films in that respect, or was there just some silly light entertainment?
Well, that's one of the big revelations about the series, is that they're all over the place. In a good way, it shows that there's a diversity of subject matter. Micheaux, he was the guy who would tackle the issues head on and make things that confronted racism from the white community, but also he would talk about racism within the Black community. But then on the other end of the spectrum, you'll have a pure entertainment, a film like The Flying Ace, which is an aviation serial in 6 episodes. Hmm. And then you'll have The Bronze Buckaroo, which is a Black cast Western. So it's all over the place. It runs the gamut, and to me, that's an important thing to recognize about the films, is it's not just you're going to see the same film over and over made by different filmmakers. It's as diverse as the films that were coming out of Hollywood. And I think in a lot of ways more interesting, because they could say things that were not being checked by the censors and the studio brass.
Yeah.
And they felt like they were speaking to the Black community. They didn't really expect a lot of white viewers to be watching these films. So they could speak a little more openly about politics within the Black community that they wouldn't say if they were making films for a white audience.
One of the fascinating finds in your collection, Brett, is it's a 1925 silent film starring this iconic film and stage actor.
Sweet soul, take heed of perjury. Thou art on thy deathbed.
To die.
I presently, therefore confess thee freely of thy sin. Thou art to die.
Wow. So that's Paul Robeson from a 1944 performance of Othello. Paul Robeson, legend, first famous Black actor, I mean to say. Obviously, that's not from the silent film. We can't really do silent film on the radio. Sorry, folks. You actually came across Robeson's first film performance, a 1925 silent movie called Body and Soul. Robeson apparently did not acknowledge this film until later in his career. What's up with that?
Honestly, the films of Oscar Michaud were never widely accepted. And to be honest, I'll expand the focus here a little bit. These films were not really considered important for decades. And even among the black community, they were, to us, to white viewers, they were curiosity items. To the black community, they were not the best representation of what they wanted African-American culture to be like. And so years later, Paul Robeson wouldn't list this in his filmography. There was not a lot of crossover from these films to Hollywood films. If you made films like this, you did a few of them, and then your career was pretty much over. And I think it was Spencer Williams is an exception, and I think that's because he had established himself in entertainment first before he began directing these films in the 1940s.
Let's try to squeeze in a couple more clips.
Sure.
The films of Oscar Michaud, who we talked about earlier, explore the complexities of being African-American and having personal relationships in that context. In the 1932 film Veiled Aristocrats, a young African-American woman is torn between a successful light-skinned man and an idealistic entrepreneur with a darker complexion. Here's a scene where she explains her frustrations to the light-skinned man.
You grew up and went through school as a white boy, so that by the time you were old enough to go with girls, you had forgotten your childhood days. It wasn't a case of being suddenly picked up and placed in a new and strenuous environment as you have placed me. I'm afraid to talk, to smile, to do anything, for fear that I'll make a mistake.
And then elsewhere in the film, we hear about the resistance to dating black women in this film. This is 1938's Birthright that we're listening to.
Listen, Peter, you don't want to do what's on your mind.
What's on my mind?
Marry a negress. You don't want to marry a negress.
Not marry a negress?
No, Peter, no. For yourself, it may make no difference, but your children, think of your children. Your son's growing up under a brown veil. A veil that you can't tear off. That God himself can't tear off.
So that makes me uncomfortable listening to that right now. Brett, is this a series of films that if people catch some of these films on Turner Classic, are they going to be made to feel uncomfortable a lot?
No, I don't think so, because Oscar Michaud, who made both of these films, kind of reels it in and sort of... He does a great job of humanizing these issues and bringing them to a resolution that kind of makes sense and are emotionally satisfying. Both films are made by Michaud, and I should mention that both of them don't exist in their entirety, and that was an important part of this entire collection. Is just because a film, in the case of Birthright, is missing its first two reels, in the case of Veiled Aristocrats is missing its first reel, and you can hear the sound quality is terrible. For that reason, these films have never been out on video before.
That's Atlanta filmmaker and producer Brett Wood. He created a collection of works by early African-American filmmakers. It's called Pioneers of African-American Cinema.